For sure. Be still and know. Responses to disciples' questions. Given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 1.
The first question. Bhagwan. Meditativeness and science are difficult to reconcile. Yet painting a picture, writing a poem, and solving a scientific problem all bring the same joy, the same joy. Why is it so difficult to be meditative and a scientist? Why has there never been a society in which the inner and the outer science, the science of gentleness and love, and the science of aggression and death live in harmony? Ananda Prabhu, the very effort to reconcile the polar opposites is wrong. You will never succeed in it. It is like trying to reconcile day and night. It is like trying to reconcile life and death. You need not reconcile them. You have only to see that they are reconciled. Day and night are perfectly moving in rhythm. Life and death are like two wings of existence. Once you see that the polar opposites can't exist separately, once you have seen that the reconciliation is not needed at all, they are already reconciled, that awareness will help you to move from one pole to another without any problem. They are totally different phenomena. Polar opposites, but all polar opposites are also complementary. Science is concentration. It is mind. It is effort. Meditation or religion is a totally different world. It is relaxation. It is let go. It is not concentration at all. It is not one-pointedness. It is no-pointedness. So how can you reconcile this? How do you reconcile work and rest? But you work hard in the day, and in the night, the rest comes on its own accord. You have earned it. Your hard work brings rest. Philosophically, reconciliation is not possible. Work cannot be rest. Rest cannot be work. If you try to create a synthesis, you will destroy both. The beauty of both. Work is work, rest is rest. But work done well brings rest. And if you have rested well in the night, in the morning you will feel so vital, so alive, so full of energy that work is needed. Rest brings work, work brings rest. It is a circle. Reconciliation is already there. Day brings night, night brings day, Life brings death, death brings life. They are half circles. Both together, the circle is perfect and complete. But please don't try to reconcile them in theory, in philosophy. In existence, watch and see how polar opposites are functioning together, hand in hand, as complementaries. That has not been done yet. In fact, humanity was not mature enough to do it up to now. Everything needs a particular time, a particular maturity to do. The East has lived religiously. That was one pole. And because it lived religiously, it has not been able to produce science. The West has lived scientifically, and because of its science, it has lost track of religion. Now, for the first time, the East is no more East, and the West is no more West. The earth is becoming one. The earth is becoming one global village. This is the time when the reconciliation can be seen, can be understood. Man is entering into a new phase. A new consciousness is to dawn. For at least 10,000 years, as far as consciousness is concerned, nothing new has happened. There have been Buddhas, and there have been Albert Einsteins, but yet we are waiting for a Buddha who is also an Albert Einstein, or an Albert Einstein who is also a Buddha. The day is coming closer and closer. Albert Einstein in his last days were very much interested in meditation, in religion. His last days were full of wonders. He said in his old age that I used to think when I was young that sooner or later all the mysteries of existence will be solved, and I worked hard. But now I can say the more we know, the more existence turns to be mysterious. The more we know, the less we know. The more we become aware of the vastness, science has not been able to demystify existence. Now this is recognized not by ordinary technicians, but by geniuses, because they are the pioneers. They can see the dawn very close by. They are the prophets. When Albert Einstein says that science has failed in demystifying existence, on the contrary, it has mystified things even more. For example, it was so easy in the old days, just 100 years before, for the scientists to say that all is matter. Now matter has disappeared. In neophysics, there is no entity called matter. The deeper the physicist went into the world of matter, the matter was not found at all. It is pure energy. how to define energy now. Is it material? Energy cannot be material. Energy is something totally different from matter. Matter is static. Energy is dynamic. Matter is a noun. Energy is a verb. Matter is miserable. Exactly that is the meaning of the word matter. It comes from miser. The root means miserable. Matter can be measured. That's why it is called matter. Energy is immeasurable. It cannot be called matter. And as the physicist has entered into the world of energy, he has become more and more puzzled. Never before he has been so puzzled. Mystics have always been in awe before existence. The physicist is for the first time in awe. Because he is for the first time touched something very vital. Otherwise he was just looking from the outside. A stone is just a stone from the outside. The physicist now knows that the stone is not just a stone. It contains universes. A single small pebble that you can hold in your hand contains so much atomic energy that the whole universe can grow out of it. Contains so much atomic energy that the whole universe can be destroyed by it. It is not just a pebble anymore. And it is not solid anymore. Although you are holding in your hand and you know it is solid, but your knowing is no more scientific. It only appears solid. It is liquid. And it looks so available, manipulatable. You can do things with it, but you don't know its mysteries, which are not manipulatable. And the mysteries are really immense. Almost as immense as the mystery of God itself. The modern physicist is using the language of the mystics for the first time. Eddington said, "The universe no more looks like a thing, but like a thought." This, from the mouth of a scientist, a Nobel Prize winner, the universe looks like a thought and not like a thing. That means the universe is more consciousness than matter. And the matter has been analyzed. Our penetration has become deeper. We have come across atoms, electrons, neutrons, and we are utterly mystified, at a loss even to express what we have come across. We don't have language, right language for it, because we had never known it. Now the right language has to be found in the words of the mystics. A Buddha will be helpful, a Lao Tzu will be helpful, and scientists are looking into the words of the Buddhas to find right language. because these are the people who have been talking about paradox, mystery. And now science is coming across paradoxes. The greatest paradox is that the electron behaves in such a mysterious way that the scientist has no language to express it. It behaves simultaneously as a particle and as a wave. This is impossible, inconceivable by the mind. Either something is a particle or it can be a wave. The same thing at the same time cannot be both. You know Euclidean geometry. Either something is a point or something is a line. One thing at the same time cannot be a point and a line together. A line means many points following each other in sequence. A single point cannot function like a line. But that's how electrons are functioning. Simultaneously, as a point and a line, as a particle and a wave. What to make out of it? How to say it? The scientist is dumb. Now he knows that the mystics who have always been talking in paradoxes, who have been saying God is far away and very close by, must be saying something through their experience. The mystics who used to say that life and death are one, not two, for the first time are becoming relevant to the scientist's mind. A new science is arising, which says it is a science of uncertainty. No more certainty. Certainty seems to be too gross. Mahavira, 25 centuries before, used to state each of his statements with a perhaps. If you had asked him, is there God? He will say, perhaps. In those days, it was not understood at all. Because how can you say perhaps? Either God is or is not. It seems so simple and so logical. If God is, God is. If He is not, He is not. What do you mean by perhaps? Now it can be understood. Mahavira was using the language in religion, the same language that is being used by Albert Einstein in physics. Albert Einstein calls it the theory of relativity. Exactly the same Mahavira has called his philosophy Sapekshavad, the theory of relativity. Nothing is certain. Everything is flexible, fluid. By the moment you have said something, it is no more the same. Things don't exist, Mahavira says, but only events. That's what modern science is saying. There are no things in the world but only events. And we cannot say anything absolutely. We cannot say this is so. Whenever somebody says this is so, absolutely, he is behaving foolishly. In the past he was thought to be a man of knowledge. The more certain he was, the more it was thought that he knows. The uncertain person, the hesitating person, was thought to be ignorant. That's why Mahavira could not influence the world too much. He had come too early. Before his time he arrived. Now is the time for him. Now he will be understood by the scientist, by the highest intelligence in the world. But he was talking to people, ordinary masses, who could not understand his syatvad, perhapsism. People wanted certain knowledge. Is there God? And Mahavira will say, perhaps. Yes, it can be said yes in one way, and it can be said no in another. And both are together simultaneously right. Now the time has come. Ananda Prabhu, don't try to reconcile. That will be a false phenomenon. Just watch. Just look deep into things as they are. They are already reconciled. There is no conflict in existence. All contraries are complementaries. You say meditativeness and science are difficult to reconcile. If you try to reconcile, they are not only difficult, it is impossible. It cannot be done. You will go mad. The very effort of reconciling them will drive you crazy. Avoid such an effort. Rather, on the contrary, simply watch. Life is paradoxical. It is already a synthesis of the paradox. The opposites are already meeting in it. All that we know and all that we need to do is a pure mirror-like consciousness, so that whatsoever life is, it is reflected. And you will see in that reflection the meeting of the opposites, the meeting of East and West, the meeting of religion and science. You say, yet painting a picture, writing a poem, and solving a scientific problem all bring the same joy, the same joy. Yes, they can. Because art is just in the middle of both. Equidistance from religion and science. Art has the qualities of both. One aspect of art is scientific, the technological aspect. Hence the scientist can paint and enjoy painting and will have the same joy. And the mystic can also paint and will have the same joy as prayer, as meditation. Although both are doing different things, the mystic's painting will be totally different from the scientist's painting. You can look, modern painting in the West is too much under the influence of technology. It has lost beauty. It is no more helpful in bringing you to the divine presence that permits existence. On the contrary, it simply reflects the insane mind of man. Looking at Western painting, you will feel dizzy, nauseous, ill. Zen masters have also painted, but their painting is totally different. Watching a Zen painting, you will feel uplifted. A feeling of subtle joy will arise in you. You would like to dance or sing or play on your flute. The Zen painting comes from the other side, the mystic side. Picasso, Dali and others come from the side of science. Now there is no similarity between a Picasso painting and the painting of a Zen master. No similarity. They are two totally different worlds. And the reason is, the painters are different. Yes, Anand Prabhu, you may be feeling the same joy in painting, writing a poem, solving a scientific problem. It is all mind. Solving a scientific problem is mind. Your poem will also be more or less mathematical, logical. It will have only the form of the poetry, but its spirit will be prose. That's why in the West poetry is dying. Painting has become ugly. A sculpture is no more representative of nature. Something immensely is missing. The spirit, the very spirit of art is missing. Looking at a Zen painting, you will be overwhelmed. Something from the beyond will start showering on you. Have you watched a Zen painting closely? There are few things you will be surprised to see. Human figures are very small, so small that if you don't look minutely, you will miss them. Trees are big, mountains are big, sun and moon, rivers, waterfalls, but human beings are very small. In the Western painting, the human being is very big. He covers the whole canvas. Now this is not right. This is not proportionate. This is not true. The human being covering the whole canvas is very egoistic. But the painter is egoistic. The Zen master is right. Man is only a tiny part in this great universe. The mountains are big, and the waterfalls are big, and the trees are big, and the stars, and the moon, and the sun. And where is man? Just the other day I was seeing a Zen painting. The man was so small. Two small figures crossing a bridge that I would have missed, because tall mountains, trees, are covering the whole painting, but there is a note underneath the painting that please don't miss, there are two human figures on the bridge. Then I had to look very closely. Yes, they were there, two human figures, very small, walking hand in hand, passing the bridge. This is right proportion. This is a non-egoistic painting. In Western paintings, you will find the whole canvas covers. In the Zen painting, only a small part of the canvas is covered. And the remaining is empty. It looks a wastage. If you are going to make such a small painting, why not use a small canvas? Why use such a big canvas which covers the whole wall and just at the corner a small painting? But the Zen people say that's how things are. Emptiness is too much all around. The whole sky is empty. How can we leave the sky? If we leave the sky, the painting will be untrue. Now, no Western painting has that vision that we are surrounded by emptiness. The earth is very small. Humanity, a very small part of the earth. An infinite emptiness all around. To be true, to be existentially true, the emptiness cannot be left outside. It has to be there. This is a different vision from a different side. Zen painting is not made in the Western way. In the Western painting, you will find the painter goes on improving. On one paint there will be another paint and still another paint, and he goes on improving and touching and doing things. Zen painters cannot do that. That is impossible. They use a certain kind of paper, rice paper, on which you can make only one stroke. You cannot correct it. You have to leave it as it is. The paper is so thin that if you try to correct, the whole thing will be lost. Why rice paper is being used? So that the mind has nothing to do. The mind is constantly trying to improve, to make things better. It has to be from the heart, a single stroke. If your heart is full of it, it will come right. But you cannot correct it. Correction comes from the mind. The same painting is never corrected. If you correct it, your correction will always show that you are not a master. It has to come out of your meditativeness, your silence. Your feel of the moment is spread on the rice paper. Art is just in the middle, equidistant from science and religion. It can be both. It can be scientific art as it is in the West. That's what you mean, Ananda Prabhu. It can be religious art. You don't know anything about it yet. Because before you can know anything about it, you will have to know what meditation is. Meditation is not a state of concentration. It is not a state of mind at all. It is a state of total mindlessness, and not a state of sleep either. No mind, no sleep. No mind, but total awareness. Out of that awareness, you bring a different quality to music, to painting, to poetry, and out of that meditativeness you can bring a totally different quality to science too. But before that can happen, we will need large numbers of meditative people around the earth. That's what my work is. That's what I am trying to do here. Creating meditators. That is the first requirement if we want to bring a new world vision where science and religion can meet. We will have to create the foundation first. Only then the temple can be raised on it. Meditation has to be the foundation. And don't try to reconcile. Just become more meditative. In your meditation is reconciliation. Because in your meditation, you become able to see that the contradictions are only apparent, that the contraries are only enemies on the surface, but deep down they are friends. It is like two friends playing chess. On the surface they are enemies, but deep down they are friends. That's why they are playing chess. They are friends. But because they are playing chess, they are pretending to be enemies. This is the leela of existence, the play of existence. God has divided himself into two. Because that is the only way to play hide and seek. It is a very beautiful play, if you understand it as play. Don't take it too seriously, because then you will not be able to see the playfulness of it. You ask me, why is it so difficult to be meditative and a scientist? It is not. It is difficult to be meditative for everybody. It is not a question of a scientist. Ananda Prabhu is a scientist. But it is the same difficulty as a businessman will feel. It is the same difficulty as the carpenter will feel. It is nothing new to the scientist. Maybe quantitatively it is a little more difficult, because his whole mind knows only one way of functioning, that of concentration. He knows only one way how to use the mind, by focusing it on a certain object. And meditation means remaining unfocused, just remaining open. Open for everything. While listening to me, you can listen in two ways. The scientific way is concentrate. What I am saying, concentrate on it. That means close your mind to everything else. The aeroplane passes by, and the train makes noise, and the traffic on the road, and the birds singing in the trees. Close your mind to everything. Just let there be only a small keyhole available to me. Only listen to me. That's how the scientist listens. He looks through a keyhole into existence. The mystic comes out of the room, stands under the sky utterly open to everything. That is another way of listening. The way a meditator listens. Then you go on listening to me, and the chirping of the birds goes on as a background to it. And what I am saying, the chirping of the birds cannot disturb it. No, not at all. It enhances its beauty. It gives its color. It gives it music. And not only the chirping of the birds, but the aeroplane passing by and sudden noise creates more silence. In contrast, when the aeroplane has passed by, you are suddenly on a deeper level listening to me. And while the aeroplane is passing and the noise is there, you listen to both. You don't become disturbed. You don't say inside, "This stupid aeroplane disturbing." The aeroplane cannot disturb, but if you say inside, "This stupid plane is disturbing me," your saying it will be a disturbance. When you will be saying it, you will lose track of me. The aeroplane cannot disturb, but your reaction to it is bound to disturb. Listening meditatively means all that is accepted, welcome. In all its multiplicity, the universe is received. You are simply open from all the sides to all that is happening, and you will be surprised. It brings such a great silence. Such exquisite silence, such profound silence. Concentration tires, meditation never tires. But it is difficult to everybody, not only to the scientist, because we have become accustomed to a certain pattern of looking at things. You will have to melt your pattern. You will have to become a little more liquid, fluid. And meditation will come to you. Don't be worried that it is difficult to the scientist. That idea can create difficulty. Once you have accepted the idea that it is difficult, then it will be difficult. Don't bring that idea. That will become auto-hypnotic. It will become a suggestion. It is not difficult. Meditation is the simplest and the easiest thing in the world. Just we have become accustomed of concentration. We have been told from the childhood to concentrate. From the primary school to the university, we have been trained for concentration. This is a kind of habituation. It takes a little time to drop the old habit. And to learn something which is not a habit, but your very nature. You say, why has there never been a society in which the inner and the outer science, the science of gentleness and love and the science of aggression and death live in harmony? Now the time has come. Everything can happen only at a particular time. Religion has come to its ultimate peak in the Buddhas. Now science is also coming to an ultimate peak. And only when two things have grown, a meeting is possible. A seed cannot meet a tree. The seed will have to become a tree. Only then high in the winds, in the clouds, they can whisper to each other. They can fall in love with each other. They can embrace each other, hug each other. They can have a dialogue. But a seed cannot have a dialogue with a grown-up tree. It is impossible. The seed will not know the language. The tree will not understand the language of the seed. Religion has been in a mature state almost for 5,000 years. Science is still growing, coming. Hence I say this time is one of the most precious times. You are fortunate to be alive today, because something immensely great is going to happen, and that is the meeting of science and religion, the meeting of East and West, the meeting of the extrovert mind and the introvert mind. It will create the new man who will be able easily to move into the outside or into the inside, who will be able to move easily into the extrovert world of science and in the introvert world of religion. Just as you move outside of your house into the garden and back into the house, it is not a problem. You don't need any reconciliation. Each time you come out of your house into the lawn, you need not make great efforts. You simply come out. It is feeling cold inside and the sun is beautiful and warm outside. You come into the lawn. You sit in the lawn. Later on, when it becomes too hot, you simply move in, because there is coolness inside. Just as you come out of your house and go in, a total man will be able to move into science and religion as easily. The inner and outer will be both his. Carl Gustav Jung has divided human beings into two, the extroverts and the introverts. His categorization is relevant for the past, but will be utterly useless for the future. Because the future man will be both together. In the past, we have always been categorizing in this way. The future man will not be a man and will not be a woman. I'm not saying biologically. Biologically, the woman will be woman and man will be man. But spiritually, the future man will have as many feminine qualities as the woman, and the woman will have as many masculine qualities as the man. Spiritually, there will never be any more labeled as man or woman. And that will be real liberation. Not only the liberation of woman, but liberation of man too. Liberation from straight jackets. Liberation from imprisoned categories. Liberation from all labels. Man is not going to be Hindu, Mohammedan, Christian. Man is not going to be Indian, German, English. Man is not going to be white and black. Not that colors will disappear. The white man will be white and the black will be black. But these will become irrelevant, trivial, meaningless. They will not be decisive. The new man will have a universal consciousness. And the foundation will be laid by the meeting of science and religion. The second question. Bhagwan, can Buddha or Christ be created or developed out of every common human being? Or is Buddha or Christ only born as such? Every man is Buddha. Every man is Christ. I feel it is not true. Balkrishna Bharati, the Buddha or the Christ cannot be created. Because the Buddha is your intrinsic nature, it need not be created. It has not to be developed either. It is already there. It is already the case. It has only to be unfolded. It has to be discovered. The treasure is there. You have to find the key to unlock the door. The treasure is not to be created. The treasure is not to be developed. Only you have to find the right key. You have forgotten about the key. The key is also with you. God provides you with everything that is needed on the journey. You come absolutely prepared. But society disturbs every child, distorts every child, because a Buddha or a Christ are useless for the society. They don't serve any utilitarian purpose. What can you do with a Buddha? What purpose he is going to serve? He will be a beautiful flower. But flowers don't serve any purpose. Flowers have to be enjoyed, appreciated, loved. You can dance around them. You can drink their beauty, but they are not commodities in the marketplace. What can you do with the full moon? You cannot sell it. You cannot purchase it. You cannot be profited by it. You cannot have a bigger bank balance because of the full moon. Hence, the society is not interested in a Buddha or a Christ. A Buddha is a full moon. A Buddha is a lotus flower. A Buddha is the bird on the wing. The Buddha is a poetry. The Buddha is a song. The Buddha is a celebration. Because they are utterly beyond utility. The society is not interested in them. It is really afraid of these people. It wants you to be slaves, to be cogs in the wheel of the society. It wants you to be servants to the vested interests. It does not want you to be rebels, and a Buddha is bound to be a rebel. A Buddha cannot follow stupid commandments given by the politicians or the moralists or the Puritans or the priests. And these are the people who are exploiting humanity, oppressing humanity. They start destroying every possibility of every human child of ever becoming a Buddha. They start crippling. They start poisoning. And they have learned many ways how to poison down the centuries. It is a miracle that once in a while a child has escaped. Somehow must have been a mistake on the part of the priests and the politicians. That a child has escaped from the trap and has become a Buddha. Balakrishna, every man is born to be a Buddha. Every man has the seed of Buddhahood in him. But I can understand your question. You say, I feel it is not true. Yes, if you look at the masses, it doesn't seem to be true. If it was true, there would be many Buddhas. But one rarely hears about a Buddha. We only know that somewhere 25 centuries before, a certain Siddhartha Gautama became Buddha. Who knows whether it is true or not? It may be just a myth, a beautiful story, a consolation, an opium for the masses to keep them hoping that one day they will also become Buddhas. Who knows that Buddha is a historic reality? And so many stories have been woven around the Buddha that he looks like a mythological figure than a reality. When he becomes enlightened, gods come from the heaven. Play beautiful music, dance around him. Now how can this be history? And flowers shower on him from the sky, flowers of gold and silver, flowers of diamonds, emeralds. Who can believe that this is history? This is not history. True. I agree. This is poetry. But it symbolizes something historical. Because something so unique has happened in Buddha that there is no other way to describe it than to bring poetry in. Not real flowers have showered on Buddha, but whenever somebody becomes enlightened, the whole existence rejoices. Because we are not separate from it. When you have a headache, your whole body suffers. And when the headache goes, your whole body feels good, a well-being. We are not separate from existence. And until you are a Buddha, you are a headache. Headache to yourself, headache to others, headache to the whole existence. You are a thorn in the flesh of existence. When the headache disappears, when the thorn becomes a flower, when one man becomes a Buddha, a great pain that he was creating for himself and others has disappeared. Certainly, I watch for it. I am a witness to it. Certainly, the whole existence rejoices, dances, sings. How to say it? It is nothing visible. Photographs cannot be taken of it. Hence the poetry. Hence these metaphors, symbols, similes. It is said, when Buddha was born, immediately the mother died. It may not be a historical fact. It may be. But my feeling is it is not a historical fact. Because it is said that whenever a Buddha is born, the mother immediately dies. That is not true. There have been many Buddhas. Jesus' mother did not die. Mahavira's mother did not die. Krishna's mother did not die. Maybe Siddhartha Gautama's mother died. But it cannot be said that whenever a Buddha is born, the mother dies. Not historically, but I know it has some significance of its own, which is not historical. By the mother is not really meant the mother. By the mother is meant your whole past. You are reborn when you become a Buddha. Your whole past functions as a womb, the mother. And the moment a Buddha is born, the moment you become enlightened, your whole past dies. That death is necessary. Now, this is absolutely true. It has happened with Mahavira, with Krishna, with Jesus. It has happened always. To say it, it is said that whenever a Buddha is born, the mother dies. You will have to be very, very sympathetic to understand these things. I can understand that it is difficult looking at the greater humanity, that there is any possibility of every human being of becoming a Christ or a Buddha. Looking at a seed, can you believe one day it can become a lotus? Just looking at the seed, dissecting the seed, will you be able to infer, conclude that each seed is going to become a lotus? There seems to be no relationship at all. The seed looks nothing. And when you dissect it, you find nothing in it, but only emptiness. instance, each seed carries a lotus within it. And each human being carries the Buddha within him. You ask me, can Buddha or Christ be created or developed? No, they cannot be created. And they cannot be developed. They have to be discovered. They have to be uncovered. They are already there. Just you have to reach your innermost core and you will find the Buddha enshrined. You will find the Christ. Christ and Buddha mean the same, the ultimate state of consciousness. And you say, out of every common human being, I have never come across a single common human being. I have come across thousands of people. I have looked into the depths of thousands of different people, but I have never come across a common, ordinary man. Every human being is unique, extraordinary, uncommon, exceptional. God never creates common human beings. God only creates unique consciousnesses. Drop this idea of a common human being. This is an insult to humanity. And you say, is Buddha or Christ only born as such? No. Nobody is born as such. We are all born alike. That too again is a trick of the mind to avoid growing. If it is settled that a Buddha is born as a Buddha and a Christ is the only begotten Son of God and Krishna is a reincarnation of God, this is a beautiful strategy to avoid. Then what can we do? If we are not Buddhas, it is not our fault. We are not born like that. And if Buddha is a Buddha, so what? He is born like a Buddha. No credit for him. He has not done anything special. If we were born like Buddha, we would be Buddhas too. But we are born like common human beings. This is a strategy, very cunning is the mind and subtle is its cunningness, beware of it. Nobody is born as a Buddha and yet everybody brings the potential of being a Buddha. And don't say that I feel it is not true, because how can you feel unless you have become a Buddha? You can only infer, you can only think, you cannot feel. Listen to me, I feel that everybody can become a Buddha. And I feel it because I was also a common human being. And then suddenly this explosion. Then suddenly this light, then suddenly this meditativeness blossoms. You can also become a Buddha. It is your birthright. Don't be tricked by your mind. Remain alert, aware. The third question. Bhagavan, I find myself mostly attracted to women and very rarely deeply to a man. I am a little bothered about it. Could you please say something about it? మా ప్రేమలోక sex has been called the original sin. It is neither original nor sin. Even before Adam and Eve ever ate the fruit from the tree of knowledge, they were having sex. And all other animals in the Garden of Eden were having sex. The only thing that happens after the eating of the fruits of knowledge was awareness. They became aware of it. And by becoming aware of it, they became ashamed. Why they became ashamed? From where this shame? They became ashamed because they saw that they are behaving just like other animals. But what is wrong in behaving just like other animals? Man is an animal too. But the ego came in. The fruit of knowledge created the ego. It created superiority, the idea of superiority, that we are superior human beings. These foolish animals, if they do certain things, they can be forgiven, but we cannot be forgiven. This is below our dignity. Sex is so fundamental an activity in nature that the ego of man started trying to get rid of it. The first thing I would like you to remember, sex is natural. There is no need to make any effort to get rid of it. Although I know a moment comes when you transcend it, but that is something totally different. It is not by your effort that you can get rid of it. If you try to get rid of it, you will fall a victim of perversions. Because for centuries man has been trying to get rid of sex, he has created many kind of perversions. Homosexuality has arisen because we have deprived people from heterosexuality. Homosexuality was born as a religious phenomenon in the monasteries. Because we forced monks to live together in one place and nuns to live in one place, and we separated them with great walls. Still now there are Catholic monasteries in Europe where for 1200 years not a single woman has entered, not even a 6 month old baby, female baby, has been allowed to enter. What kind of people are living there who are afraid of a 6 month old girl? What kind of people must have gone very much perverted, must be very much afraid they can do something, they cannot trust themselves. Homosexuality is bound to happen. It happens only in monasteries and in army, because these are the two places where we don't allow men and women to mix. Or it happens in boys and girls hostels There also we don't allow them to mix. The whole phenomenon of homosexuality is a byproduct of this whole stupid upbringing. Homosexuality will disappear from the world the day we allow man and woman naturally to meet. From the very childhood, we start separating them. If a boy is playing with girls, we condemn him. We say, what are you doing? Are you a sissy? You are a boy. You are a man. Be a man. Don't play with girls. If a boy is playing with dolls, we immediately condemn him. This is for girls. If a girl is trying to climb a tree, we stop her immediately. This is not right. This is against feminine grace. And if a girl tries and persists and is rebellious, she is called a tomboy. She is not respected. We start creating these ugly divisions. Girls would enjoy climbing the trees. It is such a beautiful experience. And what is wrong in playing with dolls? A boy can carry the dolls, because in life he will have to meet dolls. And then he will be at a loss what to do. Loka, this whole phenomenon has nothing to do with you personally. It is a social disease spread all over the world. Two English gentlemen of the old school were discussing old acquaintances one evening in their London club. What, asked one, ever became of old Kolmandli? Why, didn't you hear? Kolmandli went to Africa on a game hunt, and by Jove, the chap took up with an ape. An ape? Is the old boy queer? Heavens, no, it was a female. If it is a female, even though an ape, it is perfectly okay. We create these conditionings so deeply that out of so much conditioning sometimes people start revolting against them. Sex should be taken very naturally. We have been taken it very seriously. Either we condemn it as ugly, animalistic, or we raise it to something divine, but we never accept it as a human. And we never accept it as fun. Basically, it is fun. It is a good sport. And the humanity is going to remain burdened with ugly nonsenses if we don't accept its beauty as a sport. It is good physical activity too. And the best of exercises. You can ask the heart specialists. Now they say, sexual activity avoids heart attacks. One thing is certain, that no man has ever had a heart attack while making love. In every other kind of activity, heart attack has happened, but never making love. Have you ever heard anybody making love had a heart attack and died? No, never. It is a natural physical activity and fun. A good sport. If you take it non-seriously, then there is no need even to be worried if you are attracted to women. Don't be worried, because your worry is not going to help. It's perfectly okay. In a really free world, which is unconditioned from the primitive, ignorant past, in a really enlightened world, we will accept all these things. Yes, once in a while, you may love a woman or a man. Nothing is wrong in it. Because inside you, both are there. Each man is a man and a woman both. And each woman is a woman and a man both. Because you are born out of the meeting of one man and woman. So half of you comes from your father and half of you comes from your mother. Part of you is man and part of you is woman. So there is nothing much to be worried about. It may be your man part is attracted towards other women, but because biologically you are a woman, you feel afraid. No need to be afraid. Take things easily. That is my basic approach. Take it easy. And by taking things easy, one can go beyond them more comfortably, conveniently, quickly than by taking things seriously. If you take them seriously, you become entangled with them. You become burdened with them. And this is not such a big problem. There are bigger problems, Loka. The famous Greek ship owner, Aristotle, was having a house built on a large piece of land in Greece. He said to the architect, "Don't disturb that tree over there, because directly under that tree is where I had my first love." "How sentimental, Mr. Aristotle," said the architect. "Right under that tree?" "Yes," continued Aristotle, "and don't touch that tree over there either, because that is where her mother stood watching while I was having my first love affair." "Her mother just stood there while you were screwing her daughter?" asked the architect. "Yes," said the Greek ship owner. "But Mr. Aristotle, what did her mother say?" "Bah! There are greater problems, Loka. Your problem is nothing. At least you are attracted to other women. At least to other human beings. Perfectly okay. A little outlandish, but not too serious. things like that have been happening always. Now people have become more courageous to ask questions, particularly in the West. People have become more honest. Now no Indian will ask such a question. Not that things like that are not happening in India. They are happening. But no Indian will have courage enough to ask such a question. Loka, you ask the question, I am happy. This is sincerity. This is authenticity. One should be able to expose oneself as one is. West is becoming freer. East is very much repressed. And because East is very much repressed, it will take longer time for East to get rid of its perversions. The West is going to transcend sooner. When the Queen had her baby, she was being offered congratulations by hundreds of people. When a certain gentleman walked by, "What do you do for a living?" "I am a photographer," he replied. "Is not that remarkable?" said the Queen. "My brother-in-law is a photographer." "Is not that remarkable?" he said. "My brother-in-law is a queen." Things like that are always happening everywhere. It is part of the human scene. So don't make much fuss out of it. And don't get disturbed. You say, "I find myself mostly attracted to women and very rarely deeply to a man." Good, at least you find attracted to somebody. There is a possibility of love. There are people so dull, so dead, so insensitive that they only feel attracted towards money. Our political powers, our fame. You are in a far better situation. At least you are not in love with money. Even Ori Aristotle was in a far better situation than the people who are in love with money. But these people are not thought to be perverted. They are real perverts. Money is their whole life, their devotion. Money is their God. You are attracted to women, perfectly good. Go deep into relationship with women. If you make an anxiety out of it, you will not be able to go deep in relationship with a woman. If you go deep in relationship with women, my understanding is, sooner or later you will find that this relationship cannot be very fulfilling. Because two women are alike. And a relationship needs a certain tension to be fulfilling. A certain polarity to be fulfilling. Two women in love or two men in love will have a good relationship, but it will not be very spicy. it will be a little dull, monotonous, a little boring. But if you go deeply only, then you will become aware of these things. Your anxiety will not allow you to go deep. And then your whole life you will remain interested and attracted towards women. My approach about all the problems is that if anything is there, go deeply into it. So either you find the treasure, if it has any treasure, or you find that it is empty. In both the cases you are enriched. If you find the treasure, of course you are enriched. If you find it is empty, you are finished with it. Two women in relationship can't have a very great love affair. It will remain on the plain ground. It will not have heights and it will not have depths. So people who are afraid of heights and depths will find it very comfortable, convenient. Hence, the homosexuals are called the gay people. They look gay. They look far more gay than the heterosexuals. The heterosexuals are always going into turmoils, more conflict, more fight, less of understanding. It is bound to be so. Because two women can understand each other far better than one man and woman can understand each other. Two men can understand each other far better because they are of the same type. But the spark will be missing. Yes, a certain gayness will be there. But not great poetry. Not great romance. Mild. The relationship will be homeopathic. It will not have adventures, surprises, safe, secure, of more understanding, less conflict, less nagging. With a man and woman, there are problems. Problems of misunderstanding. They live in a totally different world. They are two different poles of consciousness. The woman thinks intuitively. The man thinks intellectually. Hence there is no meeting. The woman simply jumps on conclusions without going into any process of thought. And the man goes step by step, comes to a conclusion. The man tries hard to come to a conclusion, and the woman simply jumps to the conclusion. She has an intuitive feel. Hence you cannot deceive a woman. Not particularly your wife. That is impossible. Nobody has ever been able to do it. She will immediately see through and throw you. Because his way of seeing is not your way of seeing. She comes from the back door. And you don't know that you have a back door too. You arrange on the front door everything, and she comes from the back door and knows any all ins and outs. The husband comes home, prepares what he is going to say, how he is going to answer, everything he rehearsals. And the moment he looks at the woman, all rehearsal goes to the winds. and he is almost like a small child stuttering. Even very great people like Napoleon, he was very much afraid of the woman, his own wife, he was very much afraid. Because she will see through and through. Man's mind goes zigzag. Woman goes direct, like an arrow. She does not listen what you say. She looks into your eyes. She listens how you say it. She sees your trembling hands. She sees your eyes are trying to avoid her. She does not listen what you are saying. That is irrelevant. She knows that that is a story. You have managed to put it together on the way from the pub to the house. But she has more attunement with your body language. And your body language is more authentic because you cannot yet manage to deceive it, manage to control it. Even great actors are not able to manage the body language. For example, if somebody talks about women, you may be a celibate and you may be against all relationship and all sex. That is all in your head. But somebody can go on watching your eyes. Try this on some friend who is a brahmachari, a celibate, against all relationship and sex and all those ugly things. Just try this on him. Just start trying. Start describing naked Sophia Loren. All the curves and the beautiful body. And don't listen what he says. Look at his eyes. His pupils will become big. That he cannot control. That is beyond his control. The moment you say Sophia Lorena, his eyes are no more the same. Watch how he is moving his body. He will sit erect. If he was leaning at the back, he will come forward, closer to listen. Although he is saying, nonsense, what you are talking, this is all dirty. But he is all alert. Just now he was yawning, now he no more yawns. This I have tried. Whenever I see that somebody is yawning somewhere, I know now a joke is needed. And immediately the yawning disappears. Even Sheila comes back from her sleep. Once she is certain that now I am going to talk metaphysics, she falls in. She goes to sleep, she takes a rest. But the moment I start a joke, even in her sleep, that much she remains alert. Immediately she is back. Body has its own language. just as mind has its own language, spirit also has its own language. A man and woman are bound to be in conflict, but that conflict takes them far away and creates again and again situations for many honeymoons. A homosexual relationship is a little saccharine, too sweet, a little bit nauseating. But a man-woman relationship is always on the rocks. You cannot fall asleep. The other will not allow. They go on goading each other. And they are such different worlds. That is the attraction. Loka, you go as deeply as possible in your relationship with women. Don't be worried. Soon you will see that there is a different kind of relationship that can exist only between polar opposites. Then go into a deep relationship with man, because only by going in deep relationship with a man you will be able that all relationships fall short. Even the man-woman relationship falls short. It never brings you the contentment it promises. And only by your own experience, not what Buddhas say, not what I say, only by your own experience you will be able one day to go beyond all relationships. Then you can be happy alone. And the person who can be happy alone is really an individual. If your happiness depends on the others, you are a slave. You are not yet free. You are in a bondage. When you are happy alone, when you can live with yourself, there is no intrinsic necessity to be in relationship. That does not mean that you will not relate. But to relate is one thing, and to be in relationship is quite another. A relationship is a kind of bondage. Relating is sharing. You will relate with many people. You will share your joy with many people. But you will not depend on anyone in particular. And you will not allow anybody else to depend on you. You will not be dependent, and you will not allow anybody to be dependent on you. Then you live out of freedom, out of joy, out of love. You say, I am a little bothered about it. Don't be bothered about it at all, not even a little. Enjoy it. It is not your fault. You have been brought up by Christians, Jainas, Hindus, Buddhists. It is not your fault. What can you do? You come into a world which is already conditioned, and you come so innocent, so clean, unaware what is going to happen to you. And your parents start writing on you, and the whole society starts writing things on you. It is not your fault. It is simply symptomatic of an ill society. We have to transform the society. But the only way to transform it is to transform individuals. There is no other way. There is no shortcut. Enjoy it. It is good. Not enough. But it's still good. It will lead you into heterosexual relationship. That is a little better. Even that is not going to satisfy. Then it will lead you into meditativeness, into solitude, into that beauty, that benediction, which happens only when you are alone. That's what sannyas is all about. Learning how to be alone and yet joyous. Enough for today.